Hi, everybody, and thank you for listening to the Nurse Break live Q&A interviews. The Nurse Break is a platform for Aussie nurses and other health professionals and students to share insights into their careers and promote interprofessional learning. And I'm Jackson, and I'll be taking you through this interview. Thank you, everyone, for tuning into our third live interview. Normally, it's going to be Australian health professionals, but I figured we'll do something a bit different this time. And if you guys are watching, make sure to post your questions, where you're from, tag a friend, and get this. Let's get everybody watching this. Today we're going to be joined by KP, and let's get him on.
Hello.
Hey, KP, thank you for joining us. Thank you so much for your time. And how are you going?
Good, good. I'm currently on a period of vacation right now, so it's been pretty restful. So I've been away from the hospital for about a week now, so I'm just trying to get back into like a sense of normalcy, I guess.
Very cool. I'll give a little bit of an introduction first. So, guys, KP has been a nurse for almost 2 years. And he graduated from the Rory Myers College of Nursing in May 2018. And as part of the ICU team at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City, which has experienced one of the the US's worst outbreaks, New York. Him and his colleagues have probably seen more deaths than most people will see in a lifetime. Recently, KP has entered the public spotlight, and that's sort of how I found out about him as well. He wrote a deeply personal and touching message about his experience as an ICU nurse on his public Facebook, and it sort of went a little bit viral, and he was interviewed by Business Insider and a whole bunch of other public media organizations, and that's sort of how we sort of got in contact with KP. KP, thank you for joining again. How are you going?
Good, yeah, thanks for having me. It's good to see you. I hope we have a good conversation about what's happening in the world.
Yeah, I'm really excited. So recently, KP wrote, some of the words that he wrote was, I'll read them to you now and then we'll start. I thought I was prepared to see death. I had seen enough of it in my first year in ICU. Yet in the last 2 weeks, I have seen more people die than most people see in their lifetime, in their entire lives. Death is different now. Death could pick me. I am no hero. I am not ready to die. And KP, you then went on to say that you were considering or have written a will. Can you sort of explain some of that?
Yeah, I dislike when people say that healthcare workers signed up to die or signed up knowing that you might die. But obviously, the consequences are much more evident during a pandemic. And so I remember just going for a jog in Central Park, in New York here, where I live. And I was going for a jog, and I just realized like I didn't want to ever leave my family with the difficulty of having to sort out my family. So the idea occurred to me that I should probably have like a foundation or like a skeleton of a will, so to speak. And so I just remember writing everything down on my computer, and I looked up how to create a will, and I basically got the gist of how it should be done.
Okay. Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, I'm 25, you're 24. And I guess that's sort of the reality we're in. Guys, if you're watching, we are in Melbourne and New York, so there might be a bit of lag and a bit of technical issues, so bear with us, but we'll sort of go with the flow. I guess before we get into some of the other deeper questions, I wanted to start with what is intensive care? How does it, differ to regular care? And you're a surgical and transplant ICU nurse. What is that?
Yeah, so the ICU, so it stands for intensive care unit. And particularly in America, we have specialties. So my specialty is the surgical ICU. We also staff the transplant ICU. So it's technically two separate specialties, but it's the same nursing staff at my particular location, which is the main campus of Mount Sinai on the Upper East Side. And essentially the intensive care unit is the place where patients go when they need care that is either 1-to-1 or 2-to-1, meaning the nurse typically takes no more than 2 patients. But at that point, the patient is so sick that they need to be monitored constantly, right? Like if you're in the hospital, you don't need your blood pressure taken every minute. You won't necessarily need your temperature taken every 4 hours. You won't need a pair of vital signs like your blood pressure, temperature, heart rate, breathing rate. You won't need any of that minute to minute, but in the ICU, we record that every single minute because that's how quickly things can change. So that's essentially a rundown of what an ICU is.
Okay, and I guess, what's a transplant ICU? Are you looking after people with like organ transplants and hearts and livers and...
Yeah, that's correct. So Mount Sinai is particularly known for their transplant cases, most especially their liver, kidney, and small bowel. Small bowel being any part of the intestinal tract that might need to be resected, or if we are... Small bowel is kind of complicated in itself because the mortality rate is so high, the complications are also high. But that being said, we really take care of our patients who are pre and post transplant. So typically people who have liver transplants, whether it be through hepatitis or alcoholic cirrhosis, kidney transplants, so people who have acute kidney injury, AKI, and they ultimately need dialysis and their kidneys don't recover. We take care of them from before, right before the transplant surgery and right afterwards. So it's all very acute, but we don't deal with any intermediary like follow-up. So all the primary care follow-ups, all the lab values that you need to get worked up for in order to qualify for a transplant, we don't necessarily deal with that. But I deal with everything immediately before and immediately after.
Okay, and that sort of explains that. But are you still seeing these patients now, or like are they unfortunately falling ill to COVID at a much higher rate?
Yeah, so that's kind of hard to, I guess, to answer in the sense of when COVID had its peak here in New York, we quickly emptied out our ICU to make room for a lot of these really acutely sick COVID patients. So a lot of our patients, we essentially moved them to other parts of the hospital to try and isolate them so that they wouldn't be even in the same building. Because especially for transplant patients, for people who might not know, transplant patients are under a lot of immunosuppressive drugs, right? Once you get an organ that's not yours, you will need to be on a lifetime regimen of drugs to suppress your own immune system from attacking these new organs. So essentially they're very, very fragile as far as being compromised and as far as being prone to getting ill. Especially with COVID, we did not want that. So a lot of these patients, we tried to move to another building in the hospital. People are still needing transplants. People are still needing to get these surgeries done. But at the peak of it all, we had converted solely into an ICU for COVID patients, but now we have already converted back our surgical and transplant ICUs to their specialty. That is not to say, though, that there are not ICUs within Mount Sinai that are not non-COVID. There are still COVID ICUs. It's just that we've tried to resume all the surgeries that we needed to do because people are still having strokes, people are still having heart attacks, et cetera.
Yeah, and I guess that's the hard part. I guess before it really came to Australia, I was seeing, you know, people needing the cancer treatments and, you know, they're still having strokes and they weren't able to access that care. So, I mean, people still get hit by cars and still decide to have it. So yeah, it's a difficult one to manage. I guess what inspired you into nursing and then choosing that sort of clinical area to get into?
Yeah, I think for me, the appeal of ICU nursing, I had realized this quickly in my studies at NYU, was that like ICU nursing to me represented the specialty of nursing and wherein I could have the most autonomy. And for me, the challenge comes with having to think all the time, with having to really challenge my intellect and the gravity of having patients' lives in my hands is something obviously I don't take lightly, but it also pushes me to always ask why. And I think as a kid, like I've always wanted to know why. Like I was never complacent with just surface level information. And with the ICU, you can really specialize in the kind of care you give. So I would say I don't know everything by any means, but I like to know that after about a year and a half, almost 2 years now of working in the surgical ICU, I'm pretty efficient. If I had, like, let's say there was a patient who was crashing, like they're dying, I would be able to take that patient as my primary patient and manage them so that they don't die as soon as they arrive. And I think that's for me the appeal is also I really feel like I'm doing work that is like I can see the outcome, right? And I think that's how do I explain this? I think in certain kinds of healthcare, whether it be oncology or if you're outpatient, you don't necessarily see the changes that you can affect in a person. Mm. But in ICU care, you can really see that from the time they're admitted into, and then hopefully the time that they are either discharged or transferred to a lower level of care.
For me, the I guess, And I guess your one-to-one care, well, ideally, are you still one-to-one care with these patients, or are you one-to-three, one-to-two?
Oh, no, no, no. With other patients, I had a series of shifts where I had three patients. It was not too often. So I don't want to paint this picture like as if I was truly in the, because I'm in the trenches of it all, but the hospital, like where I work in the Manhattan location and the main campus, I was pretty fortunate not to have had three patients every single day. And a lot of other hospitals, like, and I just want to like emphasize, like, I don't really believe in putting suffering on a pedestal, but at the same time, there are nurses still out there who are taking care of three, four, sometimes five patients that are at critical care level. So right now the ratio is going back to 2-to-1 max. Obviously, if a patient's super, super sick, it's 1-to-1. But in an ideal world, these COVID patients should be 1-to-1, right? Which means for every COVID ICU patient, you should have one nurse. Because the idea is, if at any point that this patient starts to decompensate, you will need someone to take care of them fully, right? To give some context for a non-COVID patient before this pandemic started, I was the primary nurse for one of these patients. And I counted at one point, this patient was bleeding out. There were 7 nurses in the room and 4 doctors, in addition to people who were coming in and out intermittently, right? And so just that number alone, and not even accounting for the people who are running in and out, I think is indicative of how sick someone can be and how it takes a team of people, not just nurses and doctors, but respiratory therapists, patient care techs, to really save a life. So yeah, that ratio has definitely gone down for me, but by no means has it gone down to the point of normalcy pre-pandemic for a lot of hospitals here in New York.
Wow. And I guess, when I was sort of reading up on the American health system, I did come across respiratory techs quite a lot. What actually, you've just mentioned that. What is a respiratory tech? I've never heard of that before in Australia.
Okay, yeah. So in the US, we have respiratory therapists is what we call them, or you can call them respiratory techs. RT for short. It's not the same thing as RTT, which is this is the rapid code team, essentially the rapid team. They're separate. So RTs, respiratory therapists, they essentially supplement the healthcare team in terms of taking care of the patient's airway. They don't necessarily do intubations, but in a lot of other hospitals, they draw arterial blood gases, so ABGs, they titrate the vent, they know how to adjust essentially the settings on a ventilator, they do trach care. Anything typically that is associated with the patient's airway, they typically take care of. Apart from really intense moments like intubation or tracheostomies, where you put like a hole in the patient's trachea so they can breathe. At my hospital, respiratory therapists do supplementary care, but a lot of the nurses in the ICU do the care themselves. So I know how to titrate a vent. I know how to change the setting on a ventilator. I know how to set up majority of the tubing for a ventilator. I don't necessarily bring the ventilator into the room, but if you threw a ventilator at me or a patient who is ventilated, I would understand how to change those settings depending on the care that was needed.
Okay, that sort of explains that. I guess you've sort of touched on it a little bit, but what is it actually like looking after these patients, COVID patients that is, and what are you actually seeing at the bedside?
At the peak of it all, it was very much redundant, I would say, because you would get a nursing report, right? Essentially what happened before your shift, either overnight or if you're a night shift, what happened during the day. I'm a day shift nurse now, so I would get report of what happened overnight, and they would go through an assessment, basically head to toe, right? Everything from neurostatus to pulmonary status, cardiac, gastro, GU, genital, urinary, and skin. And we would essentially get these reports, but then I think what we started to all notice is that a lot of these patients had no history. Like before these surgical patients, because I think the miracle of modern healthcare is that you can prolong lives for so long, so that by the time they need to get to an ICU, they're super sick. So before, when I had all these transplant patients and all these surgical patients, they would have a history list that was like at least 3 paragraphs long. They had a resection back in 2004. They already had a previous transplant in 2008. They have a history of H. pylori. They had a Hartman procedure done. They had a Whipple procedure done in 2012. Like just all these like ridiculous procedures. You're like, how is this person still alive? Right? But now it's different because a lot of these patients are coming in and it's like, oh, they have diabetes. They're 42. They have COVID. right? Like, oh, this patient started coughing, shortness of breath, came in for fever, intubated 3 days ago. Here they are. Mm-hmm. So it was a very sad picture because a lot of the patients we were seeing were otherwise healthy people, right? Like, they didn't have conditions that affected their day-to-day lives. And so the hard part is, especially when you go into these rooms, so a lot of the patients, we doubled the rooms. So typically in an ICU room, there's one patient, right? Because it's a big bed, there's a lot of devices in the room. So to have to put two people in a room is a problem for infection control, and B, it's just space-wise, it doesn't work. Like, the amount of times I've had to squeeze between beds, or if a syringe fell, I'd have to like bend down in a contorted manner. It was just very difficult to do adequate care. But it was necessary because we were physically running out of space to house these patients, not even beds, but just physical space in the hospital. And it just looked, the cases presented themselves, the patients presented themselves pretty much the same. A lot of them were having microclots everywhere. A lot of them had AKI, acute kidney injuries. A lot of them were having a decrease in urine output. A lot of them needed dialysis. At one point, we ran out of dialysis machines. And so we also had to shift schedules. So drastically, we ran out of CVVH machines, which is a form of, it's called central veno-venous hemofiltration, which is a form of continuous renal replacement therapy with the CRRT. So it's just like, we found that there were just a lot of supplies we were struggling to meet the demands of throughout this pandemic. And that's, I think, also what was the difficult part, is like, when you look at these patients, it wasn't just a pulmonary issue anymore.
Wow, it's crazy. I mean, I'm not an ICU nurse, so I haven't personally experienced quite so much what you're explaining. I can only sort of imagine. And I guess there's only a few ICU nurses, well, ICUs in Australia that have actually had a COVID patient as well. So mm-hmm. A lot of us in Australia haven't really experienced to the extent that you guys and, you know, Spain and China are experiencing. I think our cases are at, I think, under 100 deaths just. I may be wrong, and about 6,000 confirmed cases, but, you know, most of them are recovered. What are the numbers in New York at the moment, if you know?
I honestly stopped keeping track after a while, to be totally transparent. I do know that we did surpass, in the entire U.S., we surpassed over 70,000 deaths, which is more than the Vietnam War. I know New York has more cases than most of the other countries, maybe including China. Don't quote me on that. But we have a significant number just concentrated to our state alone, and particularly the city. As of right now, though, the trend is, and as of like today, it's Friday. What is it? Friday, May 8th. As of today, the cases in New York State are going down, though. But the difference is the cases are going up across the entire U.S., like in hotspots. Mm-hmm. So good for us, bad for the U.S. overall. So a blessing in disguise, I suppose. But I do know that the cases are at least decreasing here in New York.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's hope it keeps going down. I guess what I wanted to ask was, you sort of answered that question, so I might skip to the next one, which is, have you had many patients come off the vents in your ICU and recover? Mm.
I think that's where I want to, I guess, elaborate on what does it mean to recover? Because I think a really good question, once this pandemic slows down, and even if there is a second wave, hopefully there's not, but in between waves, if we do have them, I think what's important to note is, what does it mean to recover, and how do we define that? Because is recovery you just getting off the ventilator, or how do we define quality of life after? Because a lot of these patients, they have required such an intense level of ventilator settings that I then question what their quality of life is afterward. Like, will they always need to be on a dialysis machine because their kidneys have failed? Will they always need home oxygen? Will they have trouble doing physical activity or exercise from here on out because so much of their lung capacity is just shot? Their alveoli are just no more. So I think that's a lot of the issue. that I'm thinking about. As far as are the patients who've gotten off the ventilator, there are a number of patients, but I can't produce the number off the top of my head. I don't know what the number is. I do know that the mortality rate, the number of people who die once they're on a ventilator is pretty significant. I'm pretty sure it's well over 50%. Right? That's over half. I think the last time I had read on a statistic from some study was that it was 70, 80%. I'd have to find the study specifically, and the thing too is, like, with this information, there are so many studies being thrown out there. It is hard to see which studies are accurate, which ones are truly randomized controlled trials or double blind, etc. And so it's hard not only to find good sources of information, but on top of that, it's hard to see, is this population representative of the virus that's happening across the world or just this population here in whatever area? But the mortality rate for patients who are intubated is quite high. I've extubated during the past month and a half, 2 months I've been working in the COVID ICU. I extubated 3 patients, which is great. Like, I don't know if I'm lucky or I don't know if that was just by chance, but it's a very rewarding feeling, obviously, to extubate them and then hopefully they stay extubated. Remember, like, they don't have the tube anymore, but at the same time, it makes you wonder for all the patients who do end up intubated, what's the next step? And that next step is a tracheostomy. So essentially where we cut a hole in their trachea, we put a cannula in, and then we connect them to the ventilator. So that, there are studies that show, like, after a certain amount of time, I believe it's like 10 days or so, or around that time period, like 9 to 12 days, more or less, if you stay intubated, your increase for barotrauma, so the alveoli in your lungs where the diffusion of oxygen happens, that they tend to get trauma from there, especially if you're in high settings of a ventilator, or that just in general, that the increase for ventilator-associated pneumonia or VAP, VAP, like that increases as well after a certain number of days. So we try to get these patients off, like, extubated, but if they still need the support of a ventilator, we try to trach them. And even then, the mortality is still pretty high.
Yeah, I've heard that as well. There's a lot of research, and that's the issue, I guess, with all this data, and you could almost call it fake news. It's really hard to, especially if you don't have the ability to, or are fortunate enough to have the education to be able to differentiate and discern what is good and bad information, not only for health professionals looking at research and data, but I guess also the public who are sharing emails with advice on, you know, have a hot bath and all these ridiculous things that we realize are ridiculous, but a lot of people don't realize. I guess Donald Trump, your president, even calls it fake news. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't, but we can sort of get to that a bit later. With the family issue, I mean, these patients have been looked after by nurses one-to-one at the beds. Well, you know, they're not being able to see their families. Have you, not necessarily you, but your hospital, have you created any creative ways to allow families to stay connected with patients?
Yeah, I mean, we have an iPad that we can use to FaceTime with them. And they try to coordinate it so that it's now, because once this hit, we didn't really know how to manage it, to be totally fair. And I don't think a lot of hospitals did, but I think we tried to cope with as many of the obstacles we faced. And one of them was, how do we include family, especially if they can't visit? So it's become a part of rounds when all the doctors and the medical team, they start rounding on each patient, they start talking about each patient one by one. They include, like, okay, who's going to contact the family? What time are we going to FaceTime, Skype, whatever with them today? What's the best way to do it? But in the event that they're unable to be reached at, like, let's say noon or 1, or there's an emergency that day, I try to take it upon myself to really ensure that the family, if they want to, has an accessible way to see their family member. So, like, one of my last days before I went on, like, a staycation, which is what's happening right now, one of the days that I had, one of my last shifts, one of the family members wanted to get in touch with her husband, and he had brought his phone with him, and there's a charger, and so it's very convenient in that regard that it's almost not the case most of the time. And so I would send her texts every now and then. Like, I'd be in the room, I'd have my gloves on, I'd pull out his phone, and she'd be like, she would text him every day, saying things, I love you, honey, blah, 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 even though he was sedated, intubated, like, he wouldn't be able to read it, but she just would send these texts periodically. And every so often she would send a text saying, like, how is he doing? And if I had the chance, I would respond. And so During those times, I would try to respond to her, give her updates, try to at least give her some informational tidbits to give her, not hope, but like to keep her grounded as to what was happening and to keep her, I guess, focused on what the reality was of her husband. But then on top of that, whenever I had a moment, I was like, hi, I have like 5 minutes right now. Do you want to Skype? Do you want to FaceTime with your husband? So that's like been the biggest way. Toward the end of this, we've started to let one family member, not in the room, but like come onto the unit and to at least see their family member, which has been, I guess, somewhat helpful, but it's also painful. I've been thinking the last couple of days, like, I don't know what's worse anymore. I used to think, it was terrible. It was hard to give a family member an update through the phone that their patient, that their family member is dying. But now I don't know if it's worse to look them in the eye and say, sorry, you can't go in, but here they are. And the family member is unable to touch them, to hold them, to kiss them. And they just see them tubed up everywhere throughout the door window. It's like, it's hard to articulate how heartbreaking it is to see just this look of distraught on their faces, you know? And I think that's like one of the hardest parts about this whole aspect, is not only getting in touch with family, but if they do manage to see them, what is their psychological experience for them? Because most often they're seeing their family members with tubes everywhere for the first time.
Wow. I don't even know where to go from that. I mean, you're spending so much time in the rooms, and this is I'm taking a bit of a turn here, sort of off that topic a little bit. We're wearing gowns and we're wearing masks and we're putting multiple layers on, and we're doing it, you know, for a long period of time with the patient. What is the deal with N95s and hypercapnia?
So N95 masks, this has been a particular issue for a couple of healthcare workers. So a couple of us have been experiencing some dizziness. I can attest to myself personally that I have definitely experienced some dizziness, some lethargy, some drowsiness. This is in relation to what a lot of people are thinking of when you're using an N95 mask for such a long time, which again, I want to remind people that it is not enough what we have if you have to still reuse your N95 mask out there. For any nurse across the US, and hopefully never in Australia, this has to happen to you all, but for any nurse in the US who has to reuse your N95 mask for an entire shift, I am lucky to have at least one per shift. But the basis, the foundation of our standard of care of what is scientifically proven to be effective is one mask each time you go into the room and you throw it out when you leave. And so the issue now is we're running into a lot of people who are just wearing a mask, or they're forced to wear the mask, like in my case, for 12 hours straight or for 6 hours, and then you go for lunch and you put it back on, that you're just breathing in this pocket of air. And so hypercapnia is a form of excessive gas in your blood. Essentially, one of the two main components of blood is oxygen and carbon dioxide. I guess the short version is when people breathe in oxygen, that is true, but the respiratory drive, the inherent bodily ability to continue breathing, is driven by an excess of carbon dioxide in the blood. Like, that's what triggers it in the brain. So your body's like, oh, I have too much carbon dioxide, and then you breathe to exhale the carbon dioxide out. I can get super into it, but basically carbon dioxide is really what's in the blood. The PCO2, the saturated carbon dioxide, is comprised of how quickly your body metabolizes energy, and then the byproduct is carbon dioxide. Then on top of that, how well your body can diffuse carbon dioxide through the membrane as you're breathing out. And so a lot of these things people are worrying about is when you're wearing a mask all the time, will you get hypercapnia? For people who are wearing surgical masks or scarves or whatever they need to cover their face in public, that should not be a concern. And if it is a concern, you will have symptoms that you can alleviate pretty quickly. Like, your body will compensate if you are a healthy individual in public who is not sick. So I've seen like a couple charts floating around, like, oh, you'll start to get drowsy, you'll get comatose, you'll have a fainting spell. that will only happen if you're in a setting of someone like a healthcare individual who is forced to wear an N95 mask, which really covers and seals your face differently than a surgical mask. And so that's essentially what hypercapnia is. And it's an excess of carbon dioxide, and it causes all these neurological and pulmonary symptoms. But for the general public, it shouldn't be something that they should worry about.
Okay, that sort of sums it up to anyone who was sort of having those symptoms as well. I guess on the topic of PPE, so we've heard of there's been global shortage, and you know, the Australian government put a lot of effort and money into getting PPE for us. We haven't luckily had to use it because we haven't had an influx such as you guys. I guess the question is, we've heard that you guys have been, you know, reusing masks for days and putting them in brown paper bags, which is mind-boggling because, you know, we use them. The idea of these masks is a one patient use, and you leave the room, you put it in a bin. At my hospital, we've been reusing goggles, but we clean them with, you know, the right sort of cleaning material. But it's unfathomable to reusing an N95 mask in an airborne or droplet precaution room. So what's the deal, I guess, in your experience with brown bags and PPE shortages?
That is a good question. So I don't know who was the person who thought that brown bags should be used, but it's not just isolated to my hospital or only to New York. It's a phenomenon that's happening throughout the US. So a lot of, I guess, nurses are being forced to put these N95 masks in their brown bags. I only had to reuse my N95 mask for a week, like several days at a time, for a period of 1 week. But all the other shifts that I've had throughout this pandemic, immediately starting and then for the duration of it after that 1 week in the middle, I have been able to use the same one each shift. So I haven't needed to store my N95 mask apart from that 1 week in my brown bag. That being said, there are other hospitals that aren't as fortunate and that do not have a lot of funding or resources. They have had to reuse their N95 masks. There is no study out there that shows that there is a demonstrated reuse or demonstrated safety in reusing N95 masks. At one point, the US was contemplating sterilizing these N95 masks. We haven't done that at my hospital. We've been collecting them nonetheless, just in case we need to get to that point. But I have not used a sterilized N95 mask. I think psychologically, the brown bag is a way to make people more comfortable with reusing an N95 mask, which now, after having done it for 2 months and having to use the same N95 mask for every, like, once a shift, you kind of get used to it. But I really want to call back to people to remember the fact that this is not how we should be practicing. And we're only doing this because we need to, right? It is not the job of the hospital to create PPE. It is the job of the hospital to procure PPE. But then the issue with that is it then pits hospitals against one another, whoever has the most funding or resources to do so. And so I'm fortunate to work for a hospital that has resources. And so I haven't had to suffer nearly as much as other hospitals in the outer boroughs or the outer neighborhoods of New York. But that being said, there is nothing that shows that reusing it is safe, that it prevents airborne particles from going on the inside of the mask. Especially when we eat lunch, we have to take it off, right? And we have to somehow keep it sterile or clean at the very least. And oftentimes you wonder, is what I'm doing enough to keep it clean?
So are you saying that your hospitals are beating against each other and it's not, like, centrally distributed? Is that what you're sort of saying?
Yes, that is exactly what I'm saying. And I attribute that to the US government. And that's why when I wrote that Facebook post, I really attributed a lot of the pain and suffering a lot of nurses and healthcare workers to the US government. And I named them specifically so because it is not up to the hospitals to import these PPE supplies, right? First of all, the US, so we import about 70%, I believe, 70%, somewhere in that range of PPE from China, right? From China, we import PPE, which is mind-boggling because how can you say we have a good healthcare system if what you need to protect your own medical personnel is taken from another country, right? And I think that's what boggles my mind so much about the US is we love to talk about how we're such a great country, yet we cannot even provide for our own selves. We have to import a lot of the goods. And this is not something that you need to have terrain for or like land. You can produce PPE, we just don't have factories for it. And so it comes into a bidding war because ultimately, if we're trying to buy PPE from whether it be the government or from outside sources, it then comes down to money. And then money, really, you can talk about how it stems into racial problems, like which hospital is in a poor neighborhood or which one has better funding, which one's a public hospital, which one's a private hospital. And ultimately, money comes down to a lot of what we need to get adequate PPE.
Okay, it's interesting to hear, and it's so different to us here. Yeah. Guys, if you're watching this live, post your comments, questions. I do want to know where you guys are from, where in the world you're from. Are you a nurse? Are you a doctor? I know I've seen a few paramedics who are watching. So keep posting your comments, and you've mentioned. You mentioned race and how that, you know, depending on where the hospital is, you know, sort of the socioeconomic factors that are involved in this. People of color, Black, African American, Latino populations, from my understanding, are disproportionately affected by this. And there's a few reasons for that. In Australia, our risk was, and I guess still is, was Indigenous populations, especially up in the Northern Territory, getting this in community transmission, and the Australian government acted quite quickly and sort of began to control access to the Northern Territory, and then within that, within local Indigenous communities themselves, because there are so many underlying comorbidities in these groups, and they're already at risk of dying earlier. Mm-hmm. Adding this to it in a community that's already poor with no access to ICU would be it just wouldn't go well. It would be a very, very sad story. Are you seeing underlying socioeconomic issues contributing to more death from your experiences in the ICU?
Yeah, I had spoken on a panel with NBC about this recently, and there are a lot of things that I also thought about afterward that I thought were, that we all could have mentioned. And I think one of the factors that I really want to, I guess, highlight is it's not that this virus sees Black, brown, and white differently, right? It's not that it sees like, oh, you're Filipino, right? Like I'm gonna infect you. Obviously, that is not how it works. But when we say that this virus is affecting people of color, POC, more heavily, it's because of all those other extenuating circumstances that are sociologically or racially tied. And so with the issue with money, for example, there is a health disparity in the US, and a lot of it can be tied to money, right? Like, where do we have a good education system? Where are the neighborhoods that are food deserts, that have food deserts, versus who gets access to healthy food? What is the health literacy like of people? Health literacy being like, do you understand your medications? Do you understand that eating your cultural foods may not be the healthiest thing for you? And then that's increasing your risk for developing hypertension or diabetes. And these are all factors that are sociological mostly and global public health related. And they're not necessarily hospital related, but they ultimately affect a patient's course. So when you factor in all these sociological variables, what ultimately happens is that you find that the people who are dying from this disease tend to be people of color, right? Now, obviously, if you're someone who's a person of color and you grew up in an affluent neighborhood and you had good insurance and you had good education, your risk factors are probably going to be lower. Now, you can talk about genetics and you can talk about how people of color tend to develop hypertension and diabetes more. Like, for example, how women who are white tend to have high risk for breast cancer, something like that, because of the BRCA gene or something like that. So there are always genetic influences that we can't always account for, especially because I don't think technology is as advanced as we would like to think, as far as accounting for those minute, those very subtle changes that are influenced by genetic expression. But that being said, when it comes to people of color in America, our problem is that people of color typically are poorer. And that's, like you mentioned, it's not necessarily the same case in Australia. But for us, for example, our Indigenous population, we have also, there's been many headlines right now in the news that say that Indigenous people have a high rate of infection. And then we also wonder, why is that the case? Because their health system in their communities and in their land is also not adequately prepared for this pandemic. So we can talk all about the the racial ties and how it's affecting people's health, but I think ultimately it stems down to money and education, which are some of the two biggest factors, I think, of health outcomes.
Yeah, I guess we could talk about, you know, that's another whole lecture series, but I guess the point is that COVID-19 doesn't affect people. It doesn't affect communities equally. I guess that's sort of the end point. Now, sort of following on from that, because we're sort of talking about how, you know, a lot of these communities don't have money. In Australia, if you get sick and you end up in ICU and you're tubed and you get COVID-19, you don't have to leave hospital and pay money. It's free. Do patients in the US, these 77,000 or something ridiculous like that, are they paying money once they get discharged?
I'll be honest and say that I'm unaware of their financial burden after the ICU. But everything is insurance-based here in the US. It's not like healthcare is free. So one of the big questions that people are asking is, do we still ask these patients if you manage to survive, especially if you survive being in the ICU, your medical bill is going to be a whopping amount of money. If you're in the hospital, even then, like, for example, I believe that an ambulance costs several thousand US dollars. When I had a biking accident, actually, I had a pretty severe biking accident to my forehead, and it broke my nose and everything. And I literally, I got into a cab because I did not want to pay for an ambulance. And so that is, I think, one of the biggest issues with America is that we don't have a public health system that adequately can serve people in a way that promotes better health outcomes. So, you know, when I said in the Facebook post, it was like, it's really demonstrating how inadequate our healthcare system is, because it shows A, how populations, and again, back to people of color, how they're more easily affected, but then B, how when you don't have a public healthcare system and people are forced to pay, people skimp out on their health. And so ultimately, I think that's like one of the biggest questions is like, how are these people gonna pay if they don't have enough insurance, if their insurance doesn't cover some kind of tests. And even now with testing, a lot of people are trying to promote free testing, but it's still hard to come by. We don't have adequate testing here in the US. Like, I had to go through my primary care provider to get my test done. I could have gotten it done at work, but at the beginning of this pandemic, there were so many hoops to go through. Like, at first you had to have XYZ symptoms, or then you had to have a fever specifically. It was just some kind of hodgepodge, set of protocols that we didn't sort out just yet. And now it's easier, but I had already gotten my tests. And so I think that's also an indication of how even healthcare workers are finding it difficult to get tested. Even if you don't necessarily have symptoms, and if you just want to get tested to see if you're asymptomatic, but you have antibodies, like, it's still hard to do that. It's not like you just walk into an office, sign in, and you're done. It's a lot of time and effort required to do so.
Crazy. And I guess that's another topic we could talk about for hours and hours on, you know, a fragmented healthcare system, you know, versus, you know, it's Medicare and all these things. I mean, I work in public, but I also do casual at a private hospital. And it just seems like it doesn't feel fragmented. And my understanding of the broader health system in Australia is we have it really good. We are so fortunate to live here, and it's free. I mean, no one has to think about paying money. We'll just go to some of the people who are posting comments. So we've got Andre from Brisbane. Howdy. We've got a question from Alan. I'm about to become a student nurse, and I was just wondering if you had any advice before starting nursing, if you had any tips. I think what we'll do is we might come back to some of these questions later, because they're sort of a bit off topic, but we'll definitely come back to them. What else we've got? Andre from Brendan says 97 deaths in Australia, recovery rate 88%. That's good to know. Caroline says, thank you. This is really interesting, KP. How was your PPE supply? Did you feel adequately protected/safe?
The PPE supply was better than other hospitals. Did I feel adequately protected? I will say no, but only because of the fact that I had to reuse my N95 mask. but that is not an issue with my hospital. Like, I want to really emphasize that, like, the hospital I work at, which is Mount Sinai, is doing the best that it can. Do I think hospitals can always do better? Oh yeah, 100%. I think all these hospitals could be doing a lot of better, especially with protocolizing a lot of how they take care of these patients. But that is not a jab at my hospital, because I still recognize that what I have is far better than a lot of other hospitals here in New York, even other Manhattan hospitals too. So it's not just Manhattan hospitals that are doing great. It's like, even between Manhattan hospitals, you see the disparities in PPE. I said before in an interview that unless I had a hazmat suit, I wouldn't feel adequately protected. The only reason why I said that is because when you're going in and out of these rooms and you're donning and doffing, which essentially means putting on PPE, personal protective equipment, and taking it off, there's always that risk for cross-contamination, even when you're exiting a room. And so ultimately, the hazmat suit covers you head to toe perfectly. But the big difference, though, too, in the healthcare system of the US, we have 12-hour shifts. And we don't have rooms. We don't have rooms with all these patients. We have individualized rooms. For example, if you look at South Korea, or if you look at even Hong Kong or China, a lot of these patients were might have been in a ward, but then they had an ante room, or they had a place before going on to the unit where these nurses and doctors could put on these hazmat suits, and they would work in shorter shifts, right? Like, you wouldn't be able to pee, you wouldn't be able to eat or have a sip of water, but your shifts were shorter. So the idea was that you would be protected, and that the shift changes would happen so that you could be relieved more often. And so if we had adopted that model, I think the hazmat suit would have been an excellent idea. But yeah, to answer your question and go back to my original answer, it's still no. I still think anyone who has to reuse an N95 mask should never, never think that that is enough or that is adequate, because that is not meeting the basis of which we set our standards upon by the CDC, which I dislike them so much for rolling back their standards, and I still adhere to, like, their criteria of what is minimal for protection, which is an N95 mask each time you go into a room.
Okay, and I guess sort of following on from that, hopefully, Carolyn, that answers your question. When you start your day, how do you prepare for what you're going to face? I mean, I can only imagine, you know, you already have the lack of PPE. Well, you did, I guess, even worse before. But yeah, how do you prepare, and sort of what's your process?
A lot of it is, when at the height of this pandemic, a lot of it was go to work, make sure that I started changing at work and changing out of my scrubs at work. Before, I would wear my scrubs home. Like, in the US, that's what we do. We don't have giant locker rooms. We don't have changing rooms. It's not like all these medical shows where you see the doctors and nurses, like, chatting it up in, like, some locker room. We don't have that space, especially in New York. So I really want to emphasize to people that we don't have these luxurious changing rooms, or even just an open space. We have a break room that's typically the size of two broom closets. Like, it's very tiny. We have one bathroom for, like, one unit for the nurses. So it's not conducive to changing your uniform quickly. So yeah, I would change at work, and then I would essentially, like, I would put on my scrub cap, I would put on my surgical cap, I would put on my N95, and I'd walk onto the unit. I don't eat breakfast. I typically don't have time, or I just don't feel hungry in the morning, and I get report. We do team nursing on my unit. Now, that's not true of every ICU, but basically we take report on a group of patients. So let's say that there's three of us who would take report on patients 1 through 6. And then we would get those 6 patients, and then we would decide amongst ourselves who we would want based on seniority, like, who has more experience seniority-wise, who is prepared, which at that point we're all pretty prepared to take care of sick patients. But then if you had the patient the day before, we want to advocate for continuity of care. So things like that. And that's typically how I begin my day. Also, I'm going to flip on the lights in my apartment. I realize it's getting dark because it's like the sun has set. It's like,
yeah, no problem. We got some other comments popping in. Vicky says, plus here in Australia we have COVID clinics, which is super handy and free. That's true. We got Zoira from Melbourne, sorry if I pronounced that wrong. Lots and lots of things. We'll get to some of the other questions later, guys, but keep posting your questions. What I wanted to go to next was, well, you sort of answered this question, but I did want to ask you, I guess, do you think the US government has failed healthcare workers?
Oh, yeah.
Did you want to touch on,
Sorry, what were you going to say?
Did you want to touch any more on that, or you sort of answered that, I guess?
I don't like to beat a dead horse, so to speak, but I think we failed in that we could have done a lot better. I mean, I can share links upon end that I've bookmarked about all the nurses and doctors who have died from this. And the thing is, you can't, I admit, can you protect everyone in a pandemic? No, you definitely cannot. And there will be people who will die. And I'm not naive. I'm not that naive, right? I understand that. I understand that fully, that people are gonna die. When this started happening, I understood that I would be seeing a lot of people dying. What I did not understand was how these people would die in a way that is really tormenting. And for a lot of healthcare workers too, psychologically, like I don't really ever cry. But there were a number of times that like that really pushed me almost to the point where I would be bawling in the room. Like, I have never heard people say I love you more truly to someone than in a hospital room. Truly, even before this pandemic. Like, I've been to weddings, I've been to churches, but and prayers don't ring louder than they do in hospital rooms. Like, the way you really hold on to a loved one when they're dying is so different. And I think the healthcare system failed not only in serving people, but just in our administration. Like, I don't know if the president is unaware that he's saying things that are inaccurate, or if he is lying on purpose. I don't know, because you can literally put it's at this point, it's gotten so bad that you can put clips of what he has said and how he contradicts himself. And then you still have people who try to rationalize that contradiction. And you just begin to wonder, is everyone out of their mind, or do people still believe someone who is constantly lying? It's not even an opinion at this point. It's not even subjective. It is objectively lying. Like, you have, he would say like, oh, I don't think it's real, or I don't think this is gonna be a big deal, we have it under control. There have been numerous videos out there on the internet that have recordings of him saying this. And I say that because I think that demeanor, that slow demeanor to really take the coronavirus as serious as it should have been, is what stopped us hindered us, I should say, from having adequate testing, from getting enough test kits in general. So for example, this number I do know, when I went to my primary care provider, my PCP, to get my antibody test done, I was told that they only had 100 kits. I was one of the 100 patients that they used the kits on, because I was categorized as a high risk because I work in the ICU. Now, that's in New York, and that's a clinic. Can you imagine if one clinic only has 100 test kits for the how many millions of people who live in New York? Like, to me, that's obscene, right? And so I think we're ramping up testing, but at the same time, if this had been done way before, like, for example, if you look at South Korea, that's a really good example of a really great healthcare system. Mind you, they already suffered from SARS before. Or COVID before, like SARS-CoV before. It was essentially another coronavirus. They suffered from it and they learned, right? So they did something called contact tracing, wherein once one person gets infected, they reach out to the person and they say, where have you been? Who have you been in contact with? And they trace, they literally trace who they got in contact with. There was an incident in Daegu in South Korea where one woman was called a super spreader because she infected, I think, hundreds of people at a congregation. And so this is the indication of how I think the US has failed, in that there are so many good examples of how healthcare systems across the world have managed this better, or just well in general. Like Australia, I don't know how Australia is managing it so well, especially since the beginning, I heard so many reports that that wasn't the case. But you all have such a low number of cases. Whether it be the vastness of Australia or the geographic locations or your healthcare system is better, what have you. But on top of the testing, the PPE obviously is a big issue. And then treatments. Like, I don't think we're having standardized treatments. Obviously, it's hard to do that in a pandemic. But I just think all these factors play in where it just makes the U.S. look pretty bad. There's no other way to put it. Like, it makes us look really bad for being a first world country, which I hate that term in the first place, because it puts other countries down. But it paints this picture as if we're supreme when we're really not.
Okay. Do you have advice for those who are or will soon experience a COVID outbreak? I mean, in Australia, where, I mean, as it's currently Saturday morning, and on Monday in Victoria, Melbourne, they're going to be opening up slowly, Victoria. But we're, you know, as of a few days ago, we've had an outbreak of two people in a meat clinic, which has now turned into above 70 people and infected some students and things. Then, so we're sort of moving. My understanding of Australia is outbreak management. But a really good coronavirus plan with really good leadership from, you know, all the way up the top. Do you have advice from those who may or who are experiencing this outbreak?
I would say this is where my expertise ends, as I am not a public health official or a public health informant. But I will say, from what I understand of how my rudimentary Googling, researching, whatever you like to call it, has been since this has started, what I've seen in countries that have managed it well are things like contact tracing, right? But that's also interference on personal privacy. I think that's where countries differ. And I say this because contact tracing essentially, I don't want to say violates outright, but it does climb into that territory of, or broach that territory of, at what point do we respect people's privacy over public health or public good? And I think that's the question people need to ask themselves, because, for example, in South Korea, when they're doing this, you would get a notification in your phone that says there was a person who had tested positive for COVID, and they had walked by your workplace. Please avoid this area at all costs. But that's an infringement of privacy, because that means that the government now knows where you work, and they know your typical commute path, and they know where the person who tested positive, where they walked, and where they essentially had been. And so it's this idea, is Big Brother always watching? But I think as a healthcare professional, I 99% of the time I probably will go with what is the greater good. And if that means infringing on some level of privacy, now obviously not everything. It's not like people are looking at your bank accounts. It's not like they're knowing your text messages and everything. But if it's infringing on some level of privacy, to the point where it can help contain an outbreak, I would say I'm for that, right? Another thing is wearing a mask. A lot of people in the US are, like, especially the ones who are protesting, they're so against it, which blows my mind, because it is literally the most minor inconvenience that you could possibly have to help curb the spread of COVID-19. Right? All you have to do is wear a mask. And if you don't have a mask, you can wear a scarf. There are literally so many options out there. And so for people who are so aggressively against it, even if they say, oh, it's just the flu, which bugs me to no end, even if they think it's not that serious, wouldn't you rather err on the side of caution? Wouldn't you rather err on the idea of preserving life? Even if that risk is 1%, isn't that 1% still too many? 1% of a million people is still a lot of people. Like, the people who will die, even if the risk is low, are still people who are dying, right? And so I think that's another thing, is really advocating to wear masks. And if you see someone in public or someone that you know is not wearing a mask, I think it's now the social responsibility of taking it upon yourself to have that conversation with someone and be like, okay, why aren't you wearing a mask? What is your reasoning for that? Do you inherently say you're not caring about my well-being if you're not wearing a mask? Especially if your family or friends with them, is practicing this idea that wearing a mask is not necessary. I think the onus falls on the person to have that difficult conversation, to really press them, to convince them. And if not, to understand that essentially your health is in jeopardy because of their choices.
Yeah. I guess for everyone watching, the advice in the US was for the public to wear masks. In Australia, the advice was to not wear masks.
Really?
Our situations are so different. They're not really relatable. They're effectively not relatable. But yeah, there was no, unless you were exhibiting symptoms, in which case you should be staying at home, you should be wearing a mask. But generally, the advice from the chief medical officer was to not wear a mask in Australia. And it's just ridiculous watching people have gloves on still with no mask, and they just pull their phone out and touch their face. It just bugs me to no end as well. The USA, as you mentioned earlier, has passed the amount of deaths of Americans during the entire Vietnam War. 9/11 and all these other catastrophes, you know, together. What is your perspective on the debate around opening the US economy and to those who are flaunting social distancing rules?
I think that is a touchy subject, obviously. As someone who has a job, I don't know what it is like right now to struggle financially. So I won't pretend to understand what families and individuals who are living paycheck to paycheck, what they're going through. So I will admit that, because I don't like it when people say, oh, I understand, but really they don't. And I hate that American phrase because I think it's such an easy retort to kind of like combat a discussion. I understand, but the truth is I don't. So that's where I will say it. My limitation extends. That being said, I'm for opening the economy in a way that is safe and manageable. Right now, I think that there are a number of ways we can start doing that that have seemed to be effective, like limiting the amount of people who can sit inside of a restaurant, or if you only do takeout. And the grocery stores that are still open here, they've been limiting people who are inside at one point. They're requiring here in New York City that if you go into a grocery store that you have to wear a mask. Or at least some of the grocers that I've gone to are requiring. So I think all these small changes will help curve the infection rate or the way in which people contract it as easily. And so if we continue to do that, I would be for opening the economy. But the thing is, here in the US, we have such a fragmented sense of leadership, right? If we don't have, but that's also fair though, right? Because we have 50 different states. And it is also unfair to say that what's happening in New York and what we're doing to curb the spread of the infection of the infections needs to also happen, let's say, in Alaska, right? That's also not fair to say. I acknowledge that because what's happening in one part of the country isn't necessarily what's happening in another part of the country. What I think needs to happen is that there needs to be a certain baseline of what we can do. And again, that comes from the federal government, from the US, from the president, from the coronavirus task force, which was which they also randomly, by the way, they disassembled it. They like said it was, they didn't need to have it, but then they put it back right afterward, which is the funniest thing. It's like, we are just slowing after the peak and they disassembled this task force. But these are the things that we need, is like, we need a federal, baseline, a federal, not order, what's the proper word? Like, we need some guidance essentially from the government, but then truly it is up to the states to manage it. But even within states, it differs so much, like within county to county. We have some governors who are taking a really strong lead. I can't remember which governor it was, but in the last week or so, one of the governors in the US had issued an order that people must wear a mask in public. But because of public outcry and pressure, the governor doubled back on the order. It was like, okay, that's optional. Which I think to me is also a sense of how leadership wavers so greatly. And so these are all things that will determine in the coming weeks and months of whether or not it is safe to open the economy. Because I guess to quantify safety, it's do you calculate it by the number of people who are infected or the number of people who die? You know, it's hard to say. So I also acknowledge that we can't keep the economy closed forever. That's disastrous. And it's getting to a point now where like people are really feeling the burden of having no work, of not being able to send their kids to school. All these other factors that play into reopening the economy. But I also don't think that we're at a point yet where we can just do a mass opening, because I think it'll be just open season for a lot of people with regards to this virus.
Yeah, and until there's a vaccine, then, you know, exactly. That sort of ends my questions on like COVID, I guess. Did you have anything on that sort of topic that you wanted to add? Advice to nurses, clinically, or anything like that before we get to some of the questions?
Clinically, I guess it's hard because, look, what I know now, I definitely did not know in school. Like, school does not prepare you for a pandemic. There's no pandemic crash course in a bachelor's degree. I would say if you're starting your career in an ICU, just really be prepared to always ask why. Like, you should go into work thinking you don't know anything, because truly you don't. I acknowledge that. Like, I never pretended that I knew, and I still don't know half of what I need to know. But I think that if you're always asking why, and if you're always open to being corrected, like, constructive criticism is so important, especially in the ICU. I will also say, though, for people who, whether it be in Australia or the US, if your dream or your goal is to be in a certain department, and you have the luxury of choosing, whether it be financial luxury or you have the luxury of time, I say pursue that, because so many people told me that I would not do well in an ICU straight out of college. And it was hard. It was really, really hard. But all those people now, I'm like, I made it. I did it. We made it through orientation. And I think I really want to encourage people to, I mean, this is trite, but to follow your dreams, like to really, if you believe that you can do it, do not let anyone tell you you can't. And I don't like the phrase prove them wrong, because you have nothing to prove to other people. You have everything to prove to yourself, right? That you can do it, that you are capable of doing what you think you are capable of doing. And so that's, I guess, my best piece of advice for anyone who wants to pursue, especially ICU care, which is very obviously intense because it's the ICU. In the pandemic, if you're in school or if you're orienting, there are so many ways you can help. Like there are so many people who are in nursing school or medical school who have organized food donations, or they've taken it upon themselves to do GoFundMes or other platforms to raise money, whether it be for surgical caps or for a mask, for people who are making masks, who are sewing them together to help fund that. Obviously food donations, getting PPE to smaller hospitals. I think New York has been on the receiving end, and myself included, we have been on the receiving end of so much kindness and generosity that my biggest fear now is that as cases start to spike in other parts of the country and as it starts to come down in New York, while I hope it continues to go down in New York, I'm not saying New York doesn't need any care, but I'm also saying don't forget about isolated parts of whether it be Australia or the US that might have COVID cases. Like obviously it's not over for you all, but you have it more under control, exponentially better than the US. So just don't forget really that you're not helpless because you're stuck at home. There's still so much you can do.
Good advice. And I had an ICU doctor write for me. It hasn't been released yet, but he wrote a really nice piece, but he mentioned that currently, anyway, in the ICU in Melbourne, we have sort of a collective guilt because we're being given so much outpour of love and support and, you know, food and discounts and everything, but we haven't really been hit that hard. And we also have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of nurses unemployed because they cancelled elective surgeries. And so all the nurses in private hospitals are unemployed and there's no casual work for any nurses on bank or casual positions. So all the work rurally and remotely and casually has all dried up. So for everyone who's receiving discounts, you know, the 50% off at Nando's, the free coffees at McDonald's, not everybody, because those who are, you know, working frontline with the ICU patients, with the COVID patients, sorry, may not be feeling that collective guilt. But this ICU doctor that I work with wrote that, and it was, I mean, I sort of felt that myself when we hear sort of what you guys are experiencing. Jesse has asked a question. Do you have time for some questions?
Yeah. If people are still listening, I'm happy to field them.
Let's field them. Jesse, do you fear you'll get COVID-19 yourself? And what self-care are you and your colleagues doing to protect yourself? Jesse, that's an actually awesome question.
So with COVID-19, so I mentioned earlier in the interview that I actually got tested for antibodies. I thought that I had contracted COVID like at some point in the past month and a half. I had like 2 days of like, I was really sweaty. I didn't spec a fever, but I was like creeping up on the scale. We use Fahrenheit and Celsius here, so I was like 99. It was like another issue.
I've never understood the Fahrenheit, but anyway.
Right. Like when I studied abroad in Europe, I quickly realized just how backwards the US is in a lot of ways. That's another thing. Yes, I had some symptoms that I was like, this is clearly COVID. But it disappeared after 2 days, didn't get anything terrible. I didn't have like bad coughing or malaise or body aches. So I got this antibody test and I'm negative. And that was actually something that I mentioned earlier, I guess, in another interview that I'd done was like, I was scared at the time to get it because if I test negative, then that means that, great, what I'm doing is working. All my frequent hand washing and my sterile technique or whatever is working, or that just means I've been very lucky. And so moving forward, if we have COVID patients again, which not if, when, because realistically, even though my units have converted back into not being COVID anymore, we still have patients who can become PUIs, persons under investigation, pretty quickly, right? If they start developing symptoms, if we see a chest x-ray and their whole lung is whited out, that's a good indication that they might have COVID, right? Especially with these patients who are in ARDS, acute respiratory distress syndrome, it's not the typical presentation of this. So when you're taking care of these patients and you start to suspect it, it's usually not, I don't want to say too late, but the risk is still so much higher, especially if these patients themselves, if for whatever reason they're asymptomatic and all I'm wearing is a surgical mask and I'm not in like an isolated room anymore, you know, my risk is still so much higher, especially with ventilators. Like if you're turning the patient, because a lot of these patients are sedated, they can't move. If we're turning them and for whatever reason, their ET tube becomes disconnected from the ventilator, normally that's not a problem. You just pop it back on, no problem. But the issue is as soon as it becomes disconnected, that's aerosolized. All the bacteria, all the viruses, particularly COVID in this case, are aerosolized, even if only for a moment. And so if you're only wearing a surgical mask, that lends this false sense of security of like, oh, we're fine. But if they're actually asymptomatic, then it makes me concerned now. I don't have antibodies and I'm now exposed. So I'm probably still going to wear an N95 mask at work the entire day, even though I'm not necessarily taking care of COVID patients, just in case. One of my coworkers, actually, I just found this out the other day, like 2 days ago. She had COVID. She tested positive. She was on sick leave. She got tested last week. She has no antibodies. So clearly, there is no rhyme or reason with how this is working out. And I mean, obviously, that's just one isolated case, and so is my case. And you can also question the efficacy of these tests. You can question how reliable these tests are. But then you can also question the tests that are done. Like if you're getting the swab, for example, is the tester and the skill, the technique of swabbing someone, is it precise enough? Is it reliable enough to get an accurate positive test result? So these are all factors that play in. As for self-care, I'm on staycation right now. I had this trip planned like 6 months ago. And I was like, I told my boss, I was like, I'll just keep it even though this pandemic is happening. So I've just been at home. I've been going to the grocery store. I've been coming home, and that is the extent of my outgoing activities. I've just been like, I guess, trying to take care of myself. Like my apartment fell into disarray during this pandemic. Like it just got messier and messier. So I cleaned a lot. I'm trying to cook more at home. I already cook at home a lot, but I'm just trying to have some sense of normalcy, whatever that is. I think the psychological difficulty will ebb and flow. I think that when I go back to work, I will still be reminded of what happened and all the things that I saw that were really like really sad. Like to be totally transparent, is like a lot of what was happening was really sad. The Mount Sinai, the hospital I work for, they opened up a center. It's like the Resilience and Stress Center. I don't even know the exact branding, but it was designed to treat healthcare workers and other frontline workers who have experienced a lot of trauma psychologically from this virus. So I don't know yet if I'm going to schedule an appointment there, whether it be to have one-on-one therapy. The things that I'm most interested in are they have an MRI machine to see if how people respond to stressors. They have biomarkers that they can test for. So if I feel like I still need it after this staycation, then I probably will go. But there are a number of supports.
I feel like the cortisol levels will be quite high in nurses and doctors.
100%.
I see nurse Carolyn in Melbourne has actually just said, we have 3 nurses for each COVID patient, not 1 for 3 patients! Exclamation mark. Wow. Okay. What? 3-1, not 1-3. There you go.
Three? Taking care of 1 COVID patient?
She says this. I won't put it up. It's too long. It blocks our faces. But crazy. Well, I don't know if that's reflective everywhere, but
yeah. Can you clear up for a second, though? I'm actually curious to see what she wrote.
I'll read it for everybody who's listening on Spotify. This is fascinating to hear your perspective. I am working in ICU in Melbourne and feel very lucky because your experience could have so nearly been ours. We were so lucky to have time to prepare. We were able to see it coming and had the financial resources to prepare. We have had plenty of staff to care for our intubated, not intimated, COVID patients. We have 3 nurses for each COVID patient, not 1 for 3 patients. That must have been so hard. I hope your well-being is being supported by your management team.
Yeah. So with my manager, she's been very supportive. I love my manager. I don't know if a lot of nurses across the US can say that, but my manager has done a lot to support me, and I appreciate her for that. Yeah, having the idea of having three nurses to one patient sounds like such a luxury. Like, because the thing too, I think people forget, especially who are non-medical, is that when you go into these rooms, each time you go in is like you want to limit how long you're in there for and the number of times you go in there. So to have three nurses to divide that care, I think it's wonderful. But then again, in the US, we have a nursing shortage. The number of healthcare workers per capita varies. So obviously the number of healthcare workers in New York is so much more concentrated. Even though we had to fly in traveler nurses and ask physicians to come cross state borders to come practice here, there is still much more of a concentration of healthcare workers here. But if you go to like a rural area, you might have 10 ventilators for one hospital. And if there's a sudden spike in cases that they all need to be intubated, that's where you're gonna run into problems. So that's awesome. That's great. I'm glad Australia has prepared well compared to the US.
Anne says, Annie and collective guilt experienced it too, but accept it now as society thanking us regardless of pandemic. Emily says, can I ask, and this is sort of talking about, I guess, the difference between Australia and America, I guess. I mean, the public hospital I work 0.8 at, we're on EMR, Cerner, and the private hospital I do casual shifts, I'm still having to interpret doctor's handwriting. It looks like they're having seizures when they write. It's just complete scribble, and it's unsafe. And, you know, we're writing our progress notes and stuff. From the nurses in Australia who I've spoken to who have worked in the US, apparently we are years behind. Now, Emily has asked, can I ask a non-COVID related question? Our hospital has brought in EMR. I feel like it's taking nurses away from actually caring for patients. They feel more and more like a number. Is it the same in America?
To be honest, I would say yes. I think the beauty of an EMR and why, I mean, I grew up, I'm 24, right? So I'm going to admit that I grew up in this generation of technology. So did you. So I'm more inclined to accept that method, that system. I also admit though that it does take away from the patient, because here's the issue. The mentality is if you didn't chart it, you didn't do it. So if you were, I always think about when I'm charting, if I was called into a court of law, would I be able to defend what I'm typing right now? That is always what I'm thinking, which is a terrible mentality to have. Terrible, because that means I can't just give the care as freely as I would like. Now, does that protect the patient? Yeah, because it literally lets us like zero in on our care and be more precise. So I acknowledge that the benefits of technology, I think far outweigh the negatives. But one of the biggest issues is what Amelie had touched upon, which is that you're spending, and this is still true even before the pandemic, I was spending more time typically charting or looking at a computer screen than assessing my patient. Especially when I first started out and I didn't know how to balance the two, a lot of it was like me writing out this note, and a lot of it is redundant. It's double charting, because I would say my patient's pupils were millimeter four round reactive to light, and their breath sounds were scattered ronchi, diminished at the bases, whatever. And then I would have to type a note on top of that. I would have to like, I would click those buttons in like a chart, and then I'd have to like manually write that out. And there's no standardized like note taking, like each person's note varies a little bit and the amounts that they write is different. But I always write it from the perspective of, if this patient died and their family member decided to sue the hospital and I was called in court to validate what I did, would what I typed be sufficient to defend my practice? And so that is both a blessing and a curse, because if you did it and you charted it, then good on you. But if you did it and you didn't chart it, it looks like you didn't do it. So I think there is, especially when it comes to medications, there's a lot of protection, especially because it really makes you think about what you're scanning. And it makes you avoid med errors. But I also admit that there's a lot of things like the computer's rebooting or cycling. I suppose we have to do the leap year, or we do time zone changes or whatever. That so easily screws up medical charting. So there's a lot of kinks that I still think need to be worked out. But I think it is, if you adopt the mentality that it is for the better, you will have a much easier time doing it. Because it really does, I really do think it improves care. It makes it more specific.
Yeah, I would agree. EMR has made things a lot quicker. I can see pathology results the second they come out. Exactly. You know, we can escalate things that get missed for hours or days. So it's much better for patients. Plus, you don't have to read
notes. Yeah,
notes.
Everything is very clear. Yeah.
Alan has asked, "I'm about to become a student nurse. Do you have any advice before he goes on placement?"
I think that's more for you because you're a nurse in Australia. So I think you should answer that one.
Alan, I will get back to you. I know where you are, actually. He's in Ireland about a study in the UK. I guess my advice would be ask lots of questions, be really energetic, and at the start of your shift, you want to introduce yourself. You want to have some goals and objectives. And I'll send you some links and stuff after. We'll keep this on with you. I think that's about it. There's like a few other questions. I guess one is about what drugs are you commonly using on COVID positive patients? Are you finding someone more effective in treating or stopping deterioration? I guess we can touch on this question and we might leave it at that.
So we use azithromycin and hydroxychloroquine, Plaquenil. You might have heard about it in the news, especially for any American people who are watching, that President Trump was touting its efficacy and how it was the cure-all essentially. We use that not in a way that was, I don't want to say scientific because that's looking the wrong word. It was, we used it more loosely than I think would normally have been done. Obviously this is a pandemic, so different situations happened where we had to just use things like a Hail Mary. Mm-hmm. It wasn't so much that it wasn't useful. I just think that the studies that showed it was useful, in which it showed that it was useful, were very anecdotal, or if there were studies, that they weren't strong studies. Like they weren't, like if you check them again, if they're double blind studies, that they're randomized control trials, and they have a control group. Are these studies really studies that isolate its efficacy? And mind you, a lot of what's been happening is that we are trialing these drugs, especially on my end, in the ICU. If we're giving these patients these drugs, they're already so sick. So it's hard to discern whether they're recovering appropriately because of the drug or if it's because of everything else we're doing. Because remember, like there are no treatments for COVID right now. Everything we're doing is supplementary. It just alleviates the symptoms. So like, for example, a big thing that we're doing in my hospital is proning. We put patients on their belly. We put them proned so that the dorsal part of their back, essentially their back, the back part of the lungs get ventilated better. Now there's all these other issues like chest wall compliance and will it affect PEEP, which is positive expiratory end pressure, all these things. But the studies have been showing that, especially this one, prone has been studied for many, many decades. Like I think 3 decades so far. So the last 30 years, proning is one thing that we're doing that isn't necessarily medical, but not necessarily pharmaceutical or drug related, but it's been shown to increase oxygenation. Now here's the kicker though. It's not necessarily showing improved mortality rate, which then indicates that oxygenation is not the only indicator for improved mortality. But it also, that begs the question of, if you're an ICU patient, is oxygenation the only thing you have to worry about? And the answer is probably not.
Yeah, and I guess proning has been used in ARDS as well for a long time. And I guess Anne's just said, you know, in neonates for years for RDS. So I don't know if, Kate, hopefully that answers your question. And I guess on the topic of peds, there's been this new like Kawasaki-like disease that's been popping up. Now, you don't look after pediatrics, but is this something you guys are seeing as well? Like that sort of those rashes and swollen red sort of tongues? I haven't seen it myself, but I've heard about it.
Yeah. So interestingly enough, I was reading a couple of cases that had shown somewhat related that a lot more patients are coming in. This is, again, all anecdotal because so many studies are going on and I guess the focus isn't so much on stories and how and following up on them, but more so on clinical evidence. But a lot of anecdotal stories have been shared of how neurologists are seeing more stroke victims now, especially if they're getting younger and younger, like a patient who's 40 or 35 and they have no history and they just come in for a stroke. Like that's unheard of. And so I think with COVID, people need to understand that it's not just the lungs that are being attacked. There's also a hematological condition associated with this where a lot of people are forming microthrombi, so like little clots that then scatter everywhere and cause, you know, rashes, like these purpura, like these elevations in the skin that are bloody, or strokes in this case, or in children. So my parents are actually both nurses. My mom is a pediatric ICU nurse back home in Chicago, where I'm from. And so she's been saying that we have a lot more patients. Again, she doesn't have the numbers, but she's like, I've been seeing more patients who are coming in, more children who are coming in for cardiac exacerbation or some early signs of heart failure or things that are reminiscent of Kawasaki disease. Kawasaki disease is essentially vascular inflammation, particularly in children, and then it then tends to affect the heart. So that's a concerning issue, because what happens if COVID is now either mutating, or what if this is just a symptom that we've just not noticed because it's been under our noses because we've been trying to focus on everything else? So that's definitely something we're seeing an increase of, though the numbers I cannot specify how much.
Definitely, I watch this space of the thing. I guess that's everything. I have no other questions for you. I think we've had an awesome chat, 1 hour and 25 minutes. So thank you to the 40, 50 people who've been watching the entire way, and the 30 plus comments that people have been doing. Thank you so much for coming. Any final words?
No, I appreciate the solidarity. I think it was really cool to speak to a nurse from Australia to see what was happening on your end. And I think for me, I really value understanding what's happening in other parts of the world, because what's happening in the US isn't necessarily true of other countries. And I think a world understanding is really needed to have a full grasp on this disease. So I appreciate you taking the time to message me, to ask me to come speak on your show. But then on top of that, I think just this dialogue between nurses from other countries, particularly nurses, like I'm not saying nurses are the only people who matter, but particularly nurses who tend to have voices that are stifled. I really am appreciative of how you are helping put not only the perspective of a nurse from New York in the spotlight, but also giving nurses in Australia an avenue with which that they can look toward and really hope to get guidance from as far as how to be a better nurse or what's happening during this pandemic. So good on you for giving people something to look at, to look for.
Thank you for that. Yeah, hopefully this is beneficial to nurses all around Australia. Okay, I'll leave you there, KP. Thank you so much for coming. I'll chat with you after. Cool. And I'm going to now take you off the screen. Everybody, thank you for watching, and hopefully KP has taught you something. Guys, thank you so much for watching and listening to this, probably on a podcast in the future. If you're watching this, if you listen to this on Anchor or Google Podcasts or Spotify or anything like that, thank you for doing that as well. There's so much like coming up with the Nurse Break. I've got so many cool articles, and there's so many cool people lined up for interviews as well. You know, for example, I've got a mental health and a nurse practitioner who works for the ambulance and the police force. I've got, you know, potentially the CEO of the Australian College of Nursing, Kylie. We've got some professors. We've got some doctors who used to be nurses, and they talk about medicine and nursing and how they blend together. There's grads. We've got everybody from, I guess, the healthcare team, senior, junior, and all different fields. We'll get some flight nurses on. We'll get some army nurses, everybody. Guys, so make sure to like the Nurse Break on Facebook, and you can check us on all the other socials as well. And like, guys, if you've enjoyed this, and then please just let us know, let me know, and share it, spread it, let's get it around. I think there's so much good information that we've just got out of KP today, and I think that's one of the gems about doing these live Q&As is we can learn so much from other nurses and other health professionals. We just have to give them the platform and voice to do it. Guys, I'll leave you there. Thank you so much for watching, and enjoy your Saturday or Friday in New York. Ciao.